my care to have it open before you at Genesis chapter 24. We're getting towards the end of the life of Abraham. And we are looking in this chapter at Abraham's servant rather than Abraham himself, under instructions from his master to go and find a wife for his son Isaac. Just a quick recap. We're looking at the life of Abraham because he is described in the Bible as the father of the faithful, the friend of God, and as the great example of faith. And even though Abraham lived roughly 2,000 years before the birth of Jesus Christ, we might say, well, what is the relevance of looking at this man who lived 4,000 years ago nearly? We have much to learn from him because he knew God. And God has not changed, even though the human race has changed and become, as it thinks, more sophisticated, but in fact, at heart, in our souls, we are just as bad as people were at the time of Abraham. We've followed his life. We've seen how God made promises to him, called him out of the land of his birth, which we would describe as modern-day Iraq, and into the promised land, the land of Canaan, modern Israel. And that he promised that the land would be given to his descendants, that he would have a son, and that through that son the whole world would receive blessing. God, having promised that Abraham would have a son, Abraham had to wait. And he had to wait many years until eventually, when he was 100 years old, the promised son was born. And it reminds us that when God promises to do something, God will do it. But God does it when he chooses, not when we choose. And so Abraham, being impatient, could not wait for God to fulfill his promise. And so at his wife's suggestion, he took his wife's handmaid and had a son by her. And God had to say to Abraham, sorry, that's not the promised son. I promised I'd do something for you, and I will do something for you. And I don't need a helping hand from you, Abraham. And Abraham had to wait another 14 years before the child of promise was actually born. We've seen how Abraham's faith in God was tested. Because when Isaac had grown somewhat, we don't know exactly what age, but God said, go and offer your son Isaac as a sacrifice on the mountain I direct you to. And by this time Abraham had learnt his lesson, and he realised that if God said something, God could be trusted. And he would have thought to himself, well, God said this is the one through whom the blessing is going to come. Now God's telling me to kill him. But if God's promises are going to be fulfilled through my son, then somehow or other my son must come back to life again. And so therefore, God's told me to kill him, I'll kill him, knowing that he'll be raised from the dead. And so Abraham went off and was prepared to kill his son. And God had to stay his hand at the last moment. And so we see that this kind of faith that Abraham had was the kind of faith God requires, a fully trusting faith. It's not enough just to say, oh, I believe in God. Many people do that. It's not enough to say, I believe and trust in Jesus Christ. Many people do that as well. But when you look at their lives, you think, well, they say this, but their life gives no evidence of what they say. And so you find, and it's reported quite regularly in the tabloid newspapers about certain vicars, priests, being discovered with mistresses and having all sorts of immoral affairs. And the newspapers say, well, there you are, that's what the church is like, that's what Christianity is about, and people therefore think they're able to dismiss it. But what they should do is say, well, what is Christianity about? This is what the Bible says. Clearly, these people can't be Christians. Because the Bible says that someone who is a Christian believes and trusts in Jesus Christ and seeks to live for Jesus Christ. And by their fruits, you will know them. These people show no fruits, no fruits that the Bible speaks about. So therefore, although they say they trust in Jesus Christ, quite clearly they cannot. And we can immediately dismiss a large number of professing Christians, because there is no tie-up between what they say on the one hand and the way in which they live their lives. If they are true Christians, then like Abraham, they will not only trust God and say they do, but they will obey God and do what God has said. One of the many marks of a real Christian. And then we've seen that Abraham, coming up near the end of his life, is concerned about his son. His wife Sarah has died and been buried, and now he wants a wife for his son. Abraham is getting rather old. Abraham at this stage is about 140 years old. We need to remember that people at the time of Abraham lived longer than they live now. If you plot out a graph, you find that the graph goes like this, downward but slowly levelling out to round about, on average, 70 years as it is now. But further back, the average age at which people lived was longer, and it went considerably higher. We've heard in the last week about this woman in France who is now the oldest recorded woman in the whole of human history. And as they said that, and those were the words they used, I thought, well, obviously, they've never read Genesis, because there is recorded in Genesis a man called Methuselah. And Methuselah lived until he was 969 years old. And that is recorded. So therefore, in the whole of recorded human history, there is someone considerably older than this woman. So it's foolish to say that she is the oldest woman in recorded history. Not true. Abraham beats her by quite a long way, and he only died when he was 180. But we need to remember that back in those times, people did live longer, and it's only after that that the graph drops down and levels out to be about 60. So Abraham's concerned. He doesn't know how much longer he's got to live, and he wants to get this settled, that his son has a wife, so that he can see that the promises will be fulfilled. Isaac will then have children. And we've already had a footnote back at the end of chapter 22 about the brother of Abraham, his brother Nahor, who has had children, which is important because in chapter 24 it's that very family that Abraham's servant meets. And we're not going to go through the details of the story, but here we find that the man, and we discover he has other servants with him, they come to the place, and he meets Rebecca, decides that she is the one, checks with the family, and the family say, if she wants to go, she can go. And there is a small transaction, a dowry is paid, the servant hands over various items. He has already given her a nose ring, and I doubt if it's so that he could pull her along to make sure that she came. But we read, for example, in verse 53, golden, silver, jewellery was given to Rebecca with clothing, and precious things given to Rebecca's brother and mother. So a dowry was paid. It wasn't the purchase price. There is no evidence here at all that Rebecca was being bought. Now, there are still societies in the world, and there certainly were at this time, when if you wanted a wife, you'd almost, not quite, but almost, go down to what would be considered the local market. And you'd look around and you'd say, I'll have that one. And you'd pay over the money and she'd be yours. Virtually a slave. You don't find that in the Bible. There's no element here that Rebecca is being bought. She is being asked. There is this man who wishes a wife. This is what he's like. He has great wealth. Will you go and be this man's wife? And she says yes. She's given a free choice. Will you go with this man? Yes, she says, I will go. Now, there's a couple of things I really want to pick out from this chapter. The first one concerns the way in which the servant chose Rebecca. We read the story, and he gets to the well, and he prays, and he says, Lord, let it be the woman who, when I ask her, give me a drink, she says, okay, and I'll water your camels as well. And lo and behold, almost immediately, that's exactly what happens. Now, some people read this and say, this is how we find guidance from God. Abraham's servant is a clear example. If you're not sure what to do in a particular situation, you pray about it and you say, Lord, if you want me to do this, I pray that the next car that comes down the road will be a red one. And if you want me to do that, then the next car to come down the road will be a blue one. And then they look and wait to see what colour car comes. And they think that that gives them the definitive answer in knowing what to do. But in fact, to do things in such a way is to try and manipulate God. It shows a very wrong view of God, that we should say, okay, God, come on, I can't make a decision. You make one for me. And then they make the decision, and when it all goes disastrously wrong, they turn round and they say, well, I only did what God said, it's God's fault, not my fault. They end up taking no responsibility at all for their life. How often have you done that? I know I've done it in the past. Lord, I really want this thing, I want to know what I should do. Give me some sign about what I should do. And we come up with some sign and we say, Lord, if it's that, I'll do this, and if it's this, I'll do that. And then something happens, and you interpret it as being an answer from God, and you say to yourself, but I don't like that, and it hasn't really fitted in with the size. I better refine it. And you keep on changing the conditions until you get the answer you want. Well, is that getting guidance from God? I think not. I think that's more, you've decided what you want to do, and now you're trying to make out God has told you that that's what you should do. And people do that. They keep changing the conditions and manipulating the conditions until the answer that they say they have received from God is the answer that they wanted in the first place. So why bring God into it? Why make him the one to be guilty of all these crazy decisions that sometimes people make? But they would answer, but I'm only doing what Abraham's servant did. And you also hear people when they're seeking guidance and you ask them how they're going about it, they say, well, I'm putting out a fleece. And what do they mean by that? Well, some many, many years later, in the book of Judges, hundreds of years later, in chapter 6, there was a man called Gideon. And Gideon is appointed by God to deliver Israel. And so we read in chapter 6 of Judges, and verse 36, Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only, and it is dry on all the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. And it was so. When he rose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece together, he wrung the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water. And Gideon said to God, do not be angry with me, and let me speak just once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, but on all the ground let there be dew. And God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on all the ground. And people say, there, you see, just like with Abraham's servant, we have another example in Judges chapter 6 of someone inquiring of God and God giving an answer as a result of some test that they have applied to God. Well, I'm not sure that Gideon should be so commended in this, because what does he himself say, verse 36 of Judges 6? Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, remember they were overrun by the Midianites and being severely oppressed. He says, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. And he says it again in the next verse. I will know you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. And God had said back in earlier in the chapter. Verse 14, the Lord turned to him and said, go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you? God told him quite clearly and distinctly, Gideon, you're going to deliver Israel. And now what does Gideon say? Give me a sign that you are going to do what you've said. And God could almost have said, but I've told you once. Do I need to tell you again? Now, aren't children like this? There you are. It's 9:30, 10 o'clock, whatever bedtime happens to be. And you say to your son, to your daughter, it's bedtime. Go and get ready for bed. And what do you find 10 minutes later? There they are, still in their day clothes. And you say to them, I told you to get ready for bed. Why haven't you got ready for bed? Oh, well, did you really mean that you wanted me to get ready for bed? As if you'd never made the suggestion before at all. As if you hadn't said it 10 minutes before. As if it was something incredibly unusual. You didn't really mean that, did you? And in some households, and so it goes on until at least 11 o'clock, and eventually the child is almost beaten up to bed because it just will not listen and obey. And you get that impression. But as you read a passage like this, well, isn't it somewhat childish to be told clearly this is what's going to happen, and then to say, well, I'm not sure I believe that's what you mean. Well, that's how it reads. But the interesting thing is that nonetheless, God accedes to the request. Just as God did with Abraham's servant. God acceded to the request of Abraham's servant, apparently. The conclusion they draw from the events is that this was God dealing with them in providence and saying, okay, servant of Abraham, you've asked this, I will do this. But is this? But all of us should follow. And I would say that the New Testament, which is the one that the testament that we should be following, the New Testament that tells us that that is not how we should behave. Let me give you some reasons. According to Paul in Galatians 3, in the Old Testament, God treated believers as if they were children. Doesn't matter how old they were, he treated them as children. Listen to this in Galatians 3 and verse 23. But before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith which would afterwards be revealed. Therefore the law was our tutor, our guardian, our custodian, to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. We are no longer under a guardian. But you are all sons of God through faith in Jesus Christ. And so what Paul is saying is that in the Old Testament, God dealt with believers like children. And he gave them very detailed rules and regulations. You go through the Old Testament, go through the first 5 books of Moses. You have incredibly detailed instructions as to how the people should live. Incredibly detailed. And you read through and you think, well, there's hardly anything from the whole of life has been missed out here. Almost every aspect is dealt with about how they should live. When you turn into the New Testament, you don't find, here is a list of do's, here is a list of don'ts. And so when you come to a situation, you look through the list until you eventually get, and it's always at the bottom, isn't it? When you're looking for something, like looking through this pile of Korah sheets, you're looking for something. It's always the last one or two, isn't it? And you can imagine, you're in a situation, and you're trying to find out the answer to something. Right, let's look at my list of do's and don'ts. Almost invariably the one at the bottom. Except the time you think, It's always the one at the bottom. I'll start at the bottom and work up. And of course, that's when it's the one at the top. It's infuriating, but life seems to be like that. God doesn't give us a list of rules and regulations like that. God gives us broad principles to follow. And God says, right, here are the principles. Perhaps here is a specific example. And here's how the principle works out in that specific example. Now you work the principle out in your own situation. As you would do with any adult. Oh, that's the difference. In the New Testament, believers are treated as adults. How do you think your son or daughter would like it if, at the age of 30 or 40, when they were in your house, you said to them, looking at your watch, you said, come on now, get ready for bed. How do you think they'd respond? Just a minute, Mum. Just a minute, Dad. I'm 30 years old now. I think I can work that out for myself. I am old enough. And you would probably be just very slightly offended to be told by your parents at such an age what you should do and how you should live. A lot of the problems of the teenage years, when children are turning into adults, is that the child thinks that they know it all and that they are adults already, when they're not. And the parents think that they're still children, when in fact they're in transition. And you get this conflict when the adult is still trying to explain to the child what to do in detail, and the child is beginning to learn about the transition from detailed rules to broad principles. And what you should do with children is, when they're young, you build effectively a fence around them of rules and regulations. This is what you can do, this is what you can't do. Very detailed, very structured. The child has security. Why is it so many children in our modern society haven't a clue what's going on? Of all manner of psychological problems, delinquency, and committing innumerable crimes. Why is it? It's because they've got no security. They don't know where the boundaries are. Because no one's ever set them. The parents have taken the attitude, oh, I'll let them decide for themselves. You can't do that. Not with sinners. And children are sinners just as much as adults. They will always do what their sinful hearts choose to do, unless you put a barrier around them. But as you train them and instruct them, eventually you can begin to remove those constraints and barriers, and they will become self-controlled. It's interesting to make a comparison between this country and the United States of America. I heard this comment on the radio some months ago. But in this country, the law is framed, generally speaking, in broad terms. And the courts then apply that law in specific cases. And so you will get an Act of Parliament that's, say, half an inch thick of paper. You go to the United States, and when they frame the laws, they seek to work out every single possible permutation that might come out of that law. The consequence is that their acts of Congress end up being about 3 feet thick, at least, because they try to think out every possible example. And that's part of the reason why America is such a litigious society. There are so many lawyers. And of course we have all these law programs on the television, partly to show us what wonderful people lawyers are, because in fact they're bloodsuckers. The only people that ever make money in America are the lawyers. And everybody else earns money to pay the lawyers. And that's what you learn as you watch all these programs and see the films. But it's a contrast between the adult and the child. And America, in the way it frames its legislation, is acting very much as an adult would treat a child. And in this country, we act very much as if we're dealing with adults. Now, that's not necessarily a reflection upon the two societies, but it might have something to do with the fact that our society dates back a lot further than theirs. There could be lots of reasons, but it's just an observation. And it shows the difference of the way you treat adults and children. God now treats us as adults. We do not need to have the detailed rules and regulations that were required in the Old Testament. So now we have principles that God has given to us, which we are to follow. Especially in the light of the fact that God says concerning believers in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 15. He says, "But he who is spiritual, the Christian, judges all things, yet he himself is rightly judged by no one. For who has known the mind of the Lord, that he may instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ." And in 2 Timothy chapter 1, we find Paul saying something not dissimilar. In verse 7 he says, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." God has given to believers the ability within their minds to reason from the general principles that Scripture gives to the specific. And I do not need to look through the Bible, or perhaps I should say I didn't need to look through the Bible, to find a verse that says, "Digby James, born on this date, you are to marry, Marianne said. So look out for her." And yet that's how some people seek their guidance from God. They think that somehow God has this great big blueprint, and you have to find out what this blueprint is and hunt through this blueprint. And so you get a young couple, and they are very interested in each other, but then they wring their hands and they agonize and say, "Oh dear, well, is this the right thing to do? Is it God's will? Come on, God, tell us. Have you got us together in your blueprint?" And what's God's reply? Well, nothing, because God says, "You have a sound mind. You have the mind of Christ. You decide. I've given you the principles." And the basic principles for believers are: believers only marry believers. So question one, is this person a believer? The answer is yes. They ask the question of you: are you a believer? Yes. Okay, right, now, that's the first obstacle over. Now, do we get on together? Do we like each other? Do we enjoy each other's company? Do we have the same sort of ideas about things? And then you decide yourself, under God. Well, let me give you an absurd example. Can you imagine a believer in a situation? He's married and here's a woman, not his wife, and she is suggesting that they commit adultery. Now what does he do? "Oh God, please can you give me some sign as to whether I should commit adultery or not?" You'd think he was crazy. The Bible says, adultery, that's out. That's one of the clear things God has said. No adultery. Fine. So why ask God? There are some things that are crystal clear. Those things we must do or not do. And it's the areas in between that cause people problems. And that's where they want God to speak. And God has told us all we need to know in the Scriptures. At the time of Abraham and Abraham's servant, God hadn't given all these principles. He didn't deal with them in the same way he deals with us now. And so God was gracious. God was kind. As in dealing with a child, so God dealt with him. And you can almost imagine God looking down on this man and saying, "You don't understand all the principles that have yet to be revealed in the rest of the Bible. And so therefore, I'll deal graciously with you and help you on this matter." And along comes Rebecca. God was gracious with Gideon. But he was dealing with Gideon as you deal with a child. Don't ever say to yourself, "I'll put out a fleece. God, if this happens, then I'll do this." No, that's not the way to work. Use the mind that God has given you. Then very quickly, we look at Rebecca. Rebecca was asked, "Will you go with this man?" She'd never met this man before that day. She'd never seen Isaac and had still yet to see him. "Will you go with this man?" A step in the dark. a very uncertain future. She knew certain things about him. But I would suggest to you that she trusted God. She knew that her uncle Abraham had been blessed by God. And she knew that God, the God of Abraham, was a God who could be trusted. And so when asked, "Will you go with this man?" "Yes," she says. And it's a bit like us with regard to Jesus Christ. When Jesus Christ is offered, and the preacher says, "Will you go with this man? Will you go to Jesus Christ? Will you put your trust in him for life and for eternity?" But in one sense, you are taking a step into the dark and into the unknown. Because you cannot see him. You can read about him. You can hear about him from other people. Other people can speak of their experiences, about how they, though they were great sinners, degenerate, yet God in grace came to them and took away their sin and flooded their souls with peace and joy, gave them power over sin so that they could resist the temptations that came their way, that they became godly people, and that while by no means perfect, yet they sought in every way to do that which was pleasing to God. Will you go with this man? Will you go with Jesus Christ? Will you take such a step as Rebecca took, into the dark, as it were, and yet knowing that God is a gracious and loving God, who will by no means do anything that is unpleasant towards you? When God calls people, when he calls people to trust in his Son, it is a gracious God who calls. It is a loving God who calls. It is a God who cares more for you than you care for yourself. "Come," he says, "come to my Son. You have never seen him, but one day you will." The alternative is quite dreadful, in that if we stay as we are, then this God will cease to be gracious and loving towards us, and will cast us into hell, and punish us as we deserve for our sins. And so we find that Rebecca went with the servant and came back to Canaan, and she saw Isaac, and Isaac took her as his wife. Just to note one word here that we don't misunderstand, verse 63, Isaac went out to meditate. That doesn't mean he sat cross-legged in a field and said to himself, om, or whatever one happens to be popular at the time. It wasn't Eastern meditation. He would have sat there and thought to himself, "What has God done for me? How has God dealt with me?" He would have used his mind. And that's what we've seen already. With regard to guidance, we use our minds. And when we meditate on truth. We think. We don't empty our minds, as the Eastern people urge us to do. We fill our minds and think about things. That's true meditation. Isaac took her. She became his wife. And he loved her. Notice the order here is interesting. It wasn't a question of, "Oh, I love you, now become my wife." She became his wife and then he loved her. And it helps us to remember that love is not merely some gushy, oozy feeling. It's not a mere emotion. You can choose to love and you can choose not to love. And that's important in marriage, that when the feelings apparently have gone, you can still say to yourself, "But though the feeling's not there, I will love this man. I will love this woman." And it's just as much a matter of the will as it is of the heart. Well, how do you make decisions for life? May God help you to make good decisions. Ask God for wisdom. That's what we are directed to do in James 1:5. If any man lacks wisdom, let him ask God. And that's what we need, not detailed rules and regulations. We need God's wisdom. We need skill in applying God's truth to life. So that we don't need to go running to the Bible at every occasion and reading the whole thing, trying to find out, is there something that relates to my situation? I've just got the sack from work. Now, what does it say in here at industrial tribunals? You'll look in vain. It's not there. But there are principles to apply. So apply the principles. It means thinking and using the brain. The world thinks that Christians are crazy. The world thinks that Christians have less than two brain cells to rub together. The world thinks that we are an unthinking bunch. Well, don't give them fuel for their wrong thoughts. Use the mind that God has given to you. Don't abrogate your responsibility. Do as God has directed. And remember that in living this life, we don't always know where God is going to lead us and take us. The Christian life is an adventure. It's exciting. We never know what's going to happen next and how God's going to deal with us. There's only one certainty in the whole of life, and that is that we will die. And we need to ask ourselves, am I ready to die and to face the judgment? Are you prepared for that? I'm prepared for that. Be as we are directed in the scriptures, be prepared by coming to Jesus Christ. And then you will know such peace and joy and certainty as is unimaginable.